Morning, everyone. I'm an alcoholic, and my name's Doug Robinson. Up until this morning, till I woke, I was having a pretty good time. Hour and a half won't be a problem. I asked Milt, the span between now and lunch, and somebody said lunch wasn't 11:30, and I can assure you, you won't miss too much of your lunch. So, Ray, don't ever lose what you're feeling. I mean, it's quite evident. And I think it's quite a gesture, and it's what this program's all about, when to watch the oldest, soberest member pass on something to the newest member, just like it was, I know, passed to him. I couldn't understand when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous how people knew how I felt, and it was because they came in the door just like me. No one comes in here hopping and skipping. If they do, they're on drugs or drunk. my name was wrong on the program. They misspelled our town. Tried to send something back to the post office box. It came back. Tried the email address. It came back undeliverable. And Mary asked me, she said, where are we going? And I said, I don't know, but all the latest communication devices aren't working. So I finally picked up the phone and called Milt. And he assured me that indeed this place did exist and that we were still coming, supposed to come here this weekend. So, John, thank you very much for that. I was speaking at a conference one time, and the person who introduced me was a good friend of mine from Ohio. His name was Larry, and they give us name tags just like this, and to show you how God helps me with my humility, after I'd finished my talk and later that afternoon, this one lady come up to me and she said, Larry, I sure liked what you said this morning. And I said, thank you, ma'am, and I appreciate that. And you know, those are the kind of things I get so that I don't get too big. There's always something in this program that'll keep me right sized. And if not, I'm exposed to the kind of people that will help me become right-sized if I think I'm too big or too good. I have no idea what I'm going to say. I asked God for help. My wife and I prayed this morning on our knees, as we tried to do and have been trying to do now for a few years. So hopefully God will use me, and if I say anything that makes me look like a fool, don't judge me. If God finds humor in making me look like a jackass, and you guys shouldn't judge me, and I know you won't. Two things I will tell you that I think are very important. The most important thing I can tell you is I have a sobriety date. It's February 22nd, 1986. I have not found it necessary since that day to take anything, alcohol or otherwise, to change my perception of life. And the second most important thing is I have a home group. It's the Edgewood Group in Charleston, West Virginia. We meet Monday, Thursdays, and Fridays at 7 o'clock, and if you're ever in town, we would encourage you to stop. The Al-Anon's on Thursday. We have an Al-Anon meeting in conjunction with the AA meeting. Now, they meet back here in the back and do something. I'm not sure what it is, but you hear them laughing every now and then. And we're sure they're talking about us. On Monday night, we have an open beginners meeting, and anyone that has a desire to find out anything about alcoholism or if they have a drinking problem, they're welcome to attend. And on Friday night, we have a closed mixed discussion meeting. We study the big book on Thursday night. Sometimes I think we all change it to a big book reading meeting, because some of the people at chair think that they've got to try to see how much they can read in about a 10-minute span, when actually the first paragraph that they read could be a topic of discussion for several meetings. So my sponsor gets kind of ticked at me when I suggest we change it to a big book read, the title to a big book reading meeting. I used to remind him, or I used to say, I stopped doing it because I realized it upsets him, but I used to say, where I got sober, you know, we didn't read this much. And one night he said, I really don't care how much you all read where you come from. He said, we've been doing it this way for 20-some years, and it's worked just fine. So I quit reminded him how much we read where I got sober. I was born and reared in a small town in West Virginia. Well, actually, I thought it was a large town. It was about 20,000 people. Fairmont, West Virginia. It's about 90 miles south of Pittsburgh. And I didn't really think much about life or anything. I just kind of like woke up one day and I was there. I don't even know how old I was, but somewhere I realized I was different than other people. I started realizing that I didn't fit in. I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. I've always felt different my whole life, and I couldn't understand that. I came from a dysfunctional family. Now, I did not know at the time, back in the early 60s and late 60s, early 70s, I did not know about dysfunctional family. I just thought ours was screwed up. But I've been in AA long enough and have spoken to people that have been to counselors, and they tell me when I describe my situation to them that I came from a dysfunctional family. And my sponsor told me that it had to be dysfunctional because I lived in it. That didn't help it any. I also wish my father would have been able to witness me being sober, because he didn't. My father used to think I was shiftless, lazy, and irresponsible. And I've come to find out again that what my problem was, I lacked motivation. Was my problem. If I'd have been properly motivated, things would have been better. The truth is, it wouldn't have mattered what kind of home I would have been raised in. I could have had the finest things in life, and I would have been exactly the way I was, because I had no other way to be. If things could have been different in my life, they would have been. I had to do everything, say everything, drink everything to get to where I'm at today. And the reason I know that's true, because if it was meant to be different, it would have been. I used to question things, and they would say, but it wasn't that way. You know, it makes no difference what you think may have happened or could have happened. It didn't. And that took me a long time to understand that things happen just the way they're supposed to, and that my problem always was not being able to live life on life's terms. I did not know how to do that. I wanted to be anything but myself. And I wasn't even sure what I was. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that was a statement that baffled me. They said, my sponsor, I used to hear my first sponsor, he would say, just be yourself. And I thought, well, what is that? What is myself? I did not know what myself was. I had never taken a look at myself or did any kind of self-examination of myself or my being or what I was about. I was always out looking externally. My problems were external. And I was truly a victim. Now, I did not go around saying I was a victim, but that's what I felt. I was a victim of my environment. If I'd have been raised better, if I'd have had better clothes to wear, if I'd have lived in a better house, if I'd have lived in a better town, if I'd have had different parents, if we'd have had more money, if I'd have went to the right school, if I was married to the right woman, if I had the right job, blah de blah de blah, I'd have been okay. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I was a pig, and it didn't matter where you put me. I was going to be a pig. I was just a gross example of a human being. I had no character. You didn't get character doing the way I lived. A person just don't develop good character doing the things I did. I never woke up one time from being drunk and found out that I'd spent any time helping the poor and less fortunate. It just didn't happen. My father was a drunk, and I don't know if he's an alcoholic or not. I'm fairly certain he was. And he laid out in the yard, and he could puke and sing at the same time while he was laying down. It was the most amazing thing to see. The only problem was that nobody else's father was doing that. So it was kind of embarrassing, and I already have low self-esteem and don't think much of myself. So to have my father doing that didn't lend any good effort towards my feeling good about myself. Now, what I've come to realize, what I did was I took people's outsides. I took a little bit of everybody's in the neighborhood, all the children that I ran around with and grew up with, and I took little bits and pieces of all their families, and in my mind, I had a picture of what a family should be. And the thing was that my family was coming nowhere close to being the family that my mind told me they ought to be. Now, what I realize today is that while some of those kids' fathers may not have been laying in the yard puking and singing, they very well may have been laying in the kitchen puking and singing. I have no idea what went on behind the doors of anyone's home. But it didn't matter. I took exteriors all my life. I took all the exteriors anywhere I was, and I tried to make an inside feeling for me, and it did not work. It did not work. I felt apart from. I never felt a part of anything my entire life from the earliest that I can remember. In school, it seemed like everyone else knew what they were doing. It was like everyone had a plan. Like they all got together and met maybe like a half hour before school started, and they had a plan, and when I got to school, I couldn't figure out the plan. And when I finally figured out the plan, they changed it. So I was always out of step. I could just not seem to fit in. I did not know that constantly thinking about myself was a problem. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they said the alcoholics have an ego problem. And I didn't understand what an ego problem was. I thought an ego problem meant that you thought well of yourself, because I would watch the guys that walked past the mirrors and checked themselves out as they were going by to make sure everything was just right. And someone would say, look at them, they have an ego problem. Well, I couldn't even stand to look at myself in the mirror. I felt terrible about myself. But then one night I heard my sponsor in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous make a statement that was profound to me. He said, an ego problem is not thinking well of yourself, it's thinking constantly of yourself. I thought, well, I've got one. You know, I definitely have an ego problem. I thought constantly of myself. It's still tough today not to think constantly of myself. I'm my favorite person, always have been. You know, that's, I don't mind getting up here. I get nervous because the reason I get nervous is because when I stand up here, I am representing what this program is, and that's a very important responsibility to me. I don't take anything lightly in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I realize that I'm standing up here, I'm supposed to, as long as I've been without a drink, hopefully be a little better than when I got here, and to be able to exhibit, you know, that a life can change. But I'm not worried about what I'm going to say, because I'm only going to talk about myself. I'm not going to impart any opinions, or I'm going to try not to, on what I think Alcoholics Anonymous should or should not be. You know, there's plenty of folks here that have been around Alcoholics Anonymous a lot longer than me, that if you need to have some opinions on the state of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, you're more than welcome to ask them. And you're more than welcome to ask me when I leave this podium, and I'll tell you. But when I'm up here, I'm only talking about myself, and I'm an expert on me. I live my life. No one else can tell my story any better than me. So to be able to stand up here and share that with you is an honor, because I couldn't tell anybody anything about me when I got here. I remember my sponsor saying, you just keep talking and we'll run out of the crap sooner or later. And then we'll be able to talk about you. It was about 2 years. I was about 2 years sober when I finally actually told him how I felt about something. And he didn't run away. Or he didn't chase me away. It took me a long time. The people of Alcoholics Anonymous allowed me into their lives long before I allowed anyone in Alcoholics Anonymous into mine. And that what a powerful thing that is for the people to be able. And I always want to remember to do that, to bring someone, to bring new people. And Arlene was right when she stood up here. This roundup wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the people coming. And it won't be here if you don't bring people with you. When you come into some place like this and find something, you know, take it home with you and just tell the people. And if they're willing, they'll come. And if they're not, they won't. But make the effort to try to bring them to, so that they can find what you found. I was taken to my first conference. I would have never went. I couldn't hardly stand to sit in a meeting. I was 2.5 months sober, and they told me, they said, we're going to go to this place in North Carolina. It's called Camp Monroe. And we're going to leave on Thursday night about 10:30, and we won't be back home till about Sunday night at midnight, and we're going to have a wonderful time. And I'd been around these people long enough to know they didn't drink. And I thought, now I can't hardly stand to sit in a meeting for 60 minutes and they're talking about being gone 3 whole days. And I thought, what are they going to do, you know, all weekend? They going to sit around, play checkers and talk about this AA crap all weekend? I mean, I didn't envision that as being any joyful occasion. I'm here to report that I had, for the first time in a long, long time that weekend, some of the best feelings and best times that I could have possibly had. And I didn't really want to leave, because when I left there, my world came back to me, the reality came back to me of my life and my situation. And at that time, I was 31 years old and a bum, and had a realization. My mind was starting to clear up, and I realized that there was nothing going on in my life positive or productive, and that the condition I was in and the direction I was going, if I didn't do something, I wasn't going to be alive much longer. It just wasn't going to happen. This is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard him open it up that way, so if you don't mind, I'll talk a little bit about drinking. I don't remember the first drink I had. It really doesn't matter. Drinking was not something I had to go out and discover. Like I've already told you, drinking was very prevalent in my household. Used to go to a beer joint on Saturday night where my mom and dad liked to go, and they had drawings for the six-pack and 9 and 2 six-packs at 10 and a case at 11. And I don't care what those people were doing, when they turned them lights up and rang the bell or whatever, they could have been fighting or whatever, they all stopped until that drawing was over, then they went right back to doing whatever they were doing. And I used to like to get, when I was 7, 8, 9 years old and could get up on a bar stool, I used to love to draw the names out, because no matter whose name I drawed out, unless they were a real butt, they would buy me something. You know, they would buy me some pop or give me a dollar or, you know, something. So I really enjoyed drawing the names out. Of course, unless my mom or dad won, then I didn't get anything. So I knew all about beer joints and drinking. And summer 69 was a wonderful year. I was getting ready to go into high school. I was in eighth grade in 69 and getting ready to go into high school. And I started drinking Ripple wine. It was a dollar and a penny a bottle. And I remember when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and they read that part in the book, it says we switched to natural wines. And I asked my sponsor, I said, is Ripple a natural wine? And he said Ripple really couldn't classify as a natural wine, because in order to be a natural wine, fruit had to be involved in the process of making it. And that he was fairly certain that fruit was never involved in the making of Ripple wine. So I didn't switch to natural wines. I drank this Ripple wine, and I liked, looking back, a lot of this that I know is because of being able to identify the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The identification was present when I came to my first meeting. It was present. They didn't try to sell me a TV when I come in, or they didn't ask me buy a raffle ticket. They didn't ask me how much money I had. They invited me in, they gave me a warm welcome, and I sat on the side and I listened to the people, and it was the first thing. Bill Wilson talks about it, or Dr. Bob talks about it rather, in his first encounter with Bill Wilson, when he says that Bill was the first living human being that he had ever talked to about drinking, that he knew what he was talking about. Dr. Bob knew that Bill knew. He was not talking to him from some educated standpoint about it. He knew that Bill knew, because that language of the heart, one alcoholic sharing with another. And that night I was 12-step, the first time I was ever in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 12-step by a traditional Alcoholics Anonymous group, because they were sharing the program of recovery freely. It was a big book study meeting. And they were talking, and I don't remember what they said, but what I do remember is some of them talking about the feelings that I had deep inside of me, and they were laughing about it. And the people were laughing with them. And I knew they weren't laughing at them. I knew they were laughing with them. And here, I mean, I've got these feelings deep in my gut that I could never have told anybody how I felt, that I was scared. You know, how do you walk in a bar and sit down on a bar stool and somebody says, "How you doing?" "Oh, I'm scared." "Well, what are you scared of?" "Oh, hell, I don't know." I mean, I can't walk in a bar and say that. You got to walk in a bar like you're a man. You know, I used to fight a lot when I was drinking, and it's not because I like to fight. It was I was too scared not to fight. You know, a lot of people told me to shut up, and I thought they were saying stand up. And I consequently got knocked down a lot. I'd have been better off to shut up. So I'm drinking this rip of wine, and something happened. I went to drinking 2/5 of rip of wine and didn't think anything about it. Just kind of happened, you know, just natural progression. And one, wasn't doing the job, and two, just seemed like a better deal. And along about 9 months of drinking 2 bottles of wine, we were not old enough to go in a liquor store. I was only 14 by this time, and we had a fellow that would go get our liquor for us or wine, and of course we had to buy him something. I didn't like that very well, but I wanted what I wanted, so I was willing to chip in on it. And he said, "You want your usual 2 bottles tonight?" And I said, "No, wait a minute, Bubba." I said, something clicked in my mind. I said, "I think I better have another one." And he said, "Oh," he said, "you're going to drink 3 bottles of wine now to get drunk, are you?" And that kind of started me thinking, and as any good alcoholic will recognize, when I started thinking like that, there was a crowd of people around, and they all became background noise. Because I can be all alone in a crowd of people and just think. And what I thought was, teenage wino. I saw the headlines in the paper, teenage wino. And there wasn't any in our neighborhood that I knew of. Now see, I knew what winos were, because my dad had pointed them out to me. In the town I grew up in, this one street that we'd come down all the time to go to town, it came right to the end of the bridge. And there would always be guys out there that were just, oh God, some of them were older than Milt. And they'd be standing out there in tennis shoes and overcoats, and you know, they had old raggedy beards, and you know, it'd be July, and they just didn't look like they were having a whole lot of fun. And I can remember I'd asked my father one time, "What are those guys? What are they doing?" And he said, "Well, them's winos. And you know, they drink wine and live under the bridge." So I thought, my God, here I am making this connection. I'm only 14, and I didn't want to go stay with them guys. And I kind of figured that's where winos had to go, was down there under the bridge. And I sure didn't want to be standing around in an overcoat and tennis shoes in July. So it scared me real bad, and I quit drinking wine, and I started stealing beer and vodka off my dad. And it was okay to drink the beer and vodka because my dad had never called any of them a beer-o. I thought it was the wine was the problem. Now, I can plainly understand today and have no problem understanding that alcohol was the common denominator in vodka, beer, and wine. But at that time, wine was the thing that was presenting me the problem. And it was okay in my mind to drink beer and vodka. That's how cunning, baffling, and powerful alcoholism is. It says somewhere in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous that some of us, had we realized in time what was happening to us, may have been able to quit. Now, it says that somewhere in there. And I think and believe at that time, had I truly realized what was happening to me, I would have quit. But I couldn't. I didn't realize that. So I started drinking beer and vodka and left the wine alone. That scared me so bad that I didn't drink wine for 5 or 6 months. Some of the sickest I've ever been is on wine. Thunderbird wine was some of the sickest I've ever been, was trying to stay drunk on Thunderbird wine. I did move up a little bit, I guess, in my drinking. I started drinking Boone's Farm when they came out with it. And then, well, it was a step up. It was $1.17 a fifth rather than $1.01. So it was, you know, tough coming up with 16 more cents in 1970. I got out of the Army in 1975, and it's amazing. I can remember the price of all the important items that one needs to know about. In 1975, when I got out of the service, long neck beer in a club was 45 cents a bottle. Top shelf whiskey was 50 cents a shot. Cigarettes were 35 cents in a machine. Gasoline was about 28 cents a gallon. That's all the important staples anyone needs to know. I have no idea in 1975 what a pound of ground beef cost. I have no idea what a home cost. I have no idea what a car cost. I have no idea what a loaf of bread cost, a dozen eggs. I couldn't tell you any of those things and the price of them. But the important things, I remember clearly the price of them. Because the only things I bought. I just like drinking, and it was what I was all about. It didn't matter what was going on in my life. I was destined to drink. I was going to drink as sure as the sun come up or the sun went down. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, it didn't matter. I'd call my friend Bub up. Him and I became good drinking buddies. That guy that used to purchase the booze when I was younger, and I'd call him up and I'd say, "Hey, Bub, are we going to get drunk tonight?" And he'd say, "What day is it?" I'd say, "Tuesday." He'd say, "Good a day as any." It didn't matter. Didn't have to have any kind of occasion. I used to see people out, they were getting drunk because it was their birthday. And I thought, well, it's somebody's birthday every day. it doesn't have, who needs an occasion? Those people have a problem that need a reason to get drunk. And I've heard other speakers talk about it, and people that don't drink, I don't understand why they don't, if they can. I'm like, why don't you drink if you can? It just don't interest them. There's people that live their whole life and don't drink. And that's amazing to me. I thought everybody drank. At least I thought that until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that everybody drank. Why wouldn't they? I drank my way out of high school. I started having problems too. I equate, looking back on it, I did real well in school up until the time I started drinking. I never missed any school. I had perfect attendance records. I read a lot of books. Just didn't have any problems in school. I started drinking that summer going into high school the very first week, and it was a short week because it was the Friday before Labor Day, so there was only one day. I came back on Tuesday and was suspended. I mean, I only had one day of school and I was suspended the very first day. And it really wasn't too bad, because I didn't want to go anyway. So, to get a legal suspension, I didn't have to worry about anybody, truant officers or cops or anybody picking me up, because I had papers to say I wasn't supposed to be in school. So I was to get suspended from then on the rest of the time I was in high school, and I never could understand the system very well. I'd be going 3 or 4 weeks absent from school, and they'd send a letter to my mother threatening to put her in jail if I didn't come back to school. So I didn't really want to see my mom having any problems, so I would go back. Then they would suspend me for a week. I'm not stupid. I never could understand that. I've been going for 3 weeks. I come back, you send me home. Okay. So, I would do that. I would repeat that pattern. I would stay going until they'd threaten my family. I'd go back, they'd send me home. And I still managed to have a C average. And that kind of ticked off this one assistant superintendent. My senior year, he brought me into the office, and he plainly told me that he wasn't going to allow me to do that. He wasn't going to allow me to be absent 9 weeks. And I split one semester perfectly down the middle, 45 days absent, 45 days present, and passed with a C average. And I thought about that. I never really intended to split it down the middle, but I did. I thought it was a perfect attendance, half there, half not there. So this assistant principal and I had problems that whole year, and finally in April, he was going to suspend me because I was still doing the same things and I was still passing, and he said, "You won't pass." He said, "I'll make sure of that," and I told him, I said, "Well, you do what you have to do," and in my mind, I thought, "I'll show you," and I quit. I said, "There, now you can't do anything to me because I quit." What do you think about that? Didn't bother him a bit. It didn't upset him a bit. He progressed on in his career and I believe still holds, unless he's retired, he still is assistant superintendent in that county. It never hurt him a bit because I quit high school. See, I would do things like that. I would do things to me to show you couldn't treat me the way you were treating me. I'll show you, I'll take a drink and kill myself. Now, that's not what I literally said, but that's what I was doing. That's exactly what I would do. I would show people. I was going to tell them. They just wouldn't leave me alone. people would not leave me alone. And the only people that really ever said anything to me about it are the people that really cared about me. I would be with some of my compadres, and I would look at them and I'd say, I think I have a drinking problem or something's wrong. And they'd say, oh, no, you don't. Shoot, you don't drink any more than we do. I said, okay, thanks, man. I was beginning to worry there. But see, people like my mother, my grandmother, and other family members that really cared about me, they would give me that, what the big book talks about, what the doctor's opinion talks about, that frothy emotional appeal. Now, what that was to me at the time was they were getting on my back. That's what it was. You know, it's like, leave me alone. Leave me alone. My mom, and God bless her soul, she tried, and she would say, please don't go out and drink so much tonight. You know, you're going to wreck the car, you're going to get beat up, you're going to get arrested, they're going to catch you with that pot, and on and on and on. And I'd say, Mom, you know, I'm okay. I'm 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23. The only thing I changed was the year. You know, I'm 25, I'm 26, I'm 27. You know, it's my life. And I thought my reassurance to her should suffice. And what I did was, for a number of years, rob her of the one thing that I have absolutely no right to take away from any human being, and that was her peace of mind. Because she still sat there and worried about me. My assurance, even though I gave my assurance and thought that was supposed to be okay, I would be gone for days at a time and she wouldn't know where I was. And I thought that my telling her that it was my life, I had no idea until I got sober what I did to her and the pain that I caused her. And if there was ever one person in my life that I would never want to hurt, it would have been my mother. One person. If there's truly one, it would have been my mother that I wouldn't have hurt. Because I know my mother loved me. And she did everything she could for me. She almost loved me to death. Because she would give me money and she would let me come back to her house. And she always took me in. And what the reason I realized this is what happened is about 6 months sober, I'd moved back in with my mom, and when I'd quit drinking, because I did what I heard Brian Bivens talk about it. I went where most grown men go when they don't have anywhere to go. I went back to mommy. I was not to run away from home until I was 33 years old and live on my own. I was 33 years old when I first left. What I would always do, I'd always try to find someone that was on welfare, usually a woman. And I'm sorry, it's just I've always liked women, but I would try to find a woman that was on welfare and had a place to live, and I would hang out as long as they would let me hang out with them. And so I never wanted to spend any of the money when I did work on rent or anything. I just had more important things to do with my money. Gambling and booze was the most important thing to do with a paycheck. I can remember thinking, my God, why does the gas company want $50 for me? They've got all that money. All I've got's $50. And, you know, I had real important things to do with my $50. But I moved back in with my mom, and I didn't tell her anything about Alcoholics Anonymous or what I was doing. I came and went like I'd always done when I was under her roof. Nothing much changed when I first got sober. I was still staying out half the night with AA people. They were sitting up with me. Because I was just in such bad shape and they didn't want to leave me alone. I look back on it now. I didn't realize they had jobs, those people. My sponsor and a couple other guys. I think that he got them together. I know what he did now. I mean, after being sober for a while, I kind of figured it out. And then they told me is they got together and like set up a schedule of who was going to sit with me. And they would do that. They would sit with me till 1 or 2 in the morning until I could go home and pass out from sheer exhaustion. Not from drinking, but just from sheer exhaustion. And I didn't realize these fellows had to get up very early in the morning and go to work because I didn't have a job. You know, I came here like most good drunks without a job. And anyway, I'm coming in out of my mom's house. And one time, after about 6 months, I left that house. And she said something real pleasant to me, like, you know, you're going to be back for dinner or have a good day or something like that. And I was about 5 or 6 blocks from her house when I realized it came to me. Not one time in these months that I've been living with her has she been on my back. Has she made any comments to me like, you know, don't drink so much tonight, you're going to get in jail, you're going to get beat up? And there, I just knew there was something different. Then I had to ask why. Why is there something different when she's not saying these things to me? Could it be that it's because I haven't awoken her home, half in bed, half out? Could it be I've not woke up in the front yard, half on the porch, half off? Could it be that I've not come to in my car with the engine still running and door open and me hanging out on the, you know, pavement? That's the kind of things I wouldn't do. See, my mom was handicapped and she couldn't get out to the car. And she used to, my sister, they shared some of these stories with me after I sobered. She used to call my sister up. My sister would come at 3 or 4 in the morning or 5 and get me out of my car and carry me in the house or drag me in. And, you know, just my mother was, you know, sitting there looking out the window and she couldn't come out and help me. I woke up one morning, guy across the street. It's embarrassing is what it is, but, you know, it didn't stop me from drinking. But there was a peck on my window, car window, and I look up, and I recognize the guy. It's my mom's neighbor. And he says, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Yeah, I think so." And he said, "Well, shut your car off." It was still running. I have no idea how long I was there. I have no idea, and it was scary because no matter how you get to my mom's, you got to traverse some pretty curvy roads. And yet God saw fit to get me there because I was there and had enough left in me to put it in park and fall over. I was still, my feet and everything was over in the driver's position, but I just was, had fell across the seat. And I thought, you know, how did I get here? You know, how did I just, I had enough to make it right to here. And I just drove like that many times because I couldn't walk when I was drunk. I had to drive. I was a falling down drunk. I was a puking drunk. I mean, I was bad shape. I never told anybody the truth about me. I wouldn't go ask for a job and a prospective employer. And had I told people the truth, I would have had a lot less problems in my life. But I would never go say to someone, you know, I'd like to apply for the job. I think I could do it. However, I need to tell you something about myself. I drink a lot. I probably won't be able to show up most of the time. And when I do show up, I'm going to be so sick that I won't be able to work. But I'd like to have the job, and I'd like for you to pay me fairly regular. I doubt if they would have hired me. I don't ever remember going to someone and saying, you know, I'd like to rent this house. However, I need to tell you something about myself. I drink a lot. There's a lot of people like me that drink a lot that's going to be in your house. Cops will be here quite frequently. Some of your windows will be gone within a matter of weeks, and probably by the time I leave here, the back door won't be on its hinges. But would you rent to me? But yet I would get mad when those things would happen and they'd want to throw me out. I would never see a woman that I was attracted to and say, "I'm attracted to you, I'd like to go out with you." But I got to tell you a little bit about myself. I drink a lot. And if you got enough money to pay for the date, I'd like to go out with you. I'll probably puke on you first or second time we're out. You know, I would never tell, but then I couldn't understand why no one wanted to have anything to do with me. I just couldn't understand it. I was a legend in my own mind. I thought I was together. I thought when I took a drink, it brought me and everything in my world together. Now, what I understand today, when I take a drink, I come completely apart. Completely. I don't know about anywhere else, but it seemed like where I was getting sober and the guys I would sponsor, if they would drink, they would always find a need to come and tell you why they drank if you'd see them in public. And this one guy, and I knew he was having some trouble, and I knew he was losing his job, and I could tell he was drinking when he hollered at me and run across four lanes of traffic to explain to me why he'd taken a drink. And he told me that he'd just been laid off and the place was going to close down. He had wife and kids, and he said so much pressure. He said, "I just had to take a drink to get my head together. Do you know what I'm talking about?" And I thought, "Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I used to take a drink, get my head together all the time. All the time to think about it. You know, I'd get in some kind of trouble and I'd have to take a drink to think about it. Well, I'd think my way on through it. Somebody else would handle it, the problem, whatever it was. It would always just go away. The courts would handle it. My grandmother would handle it. My mom, somebody would handle it, because I would just drink my way right on through it. I never wanted to accept responsibility for me or my actions. Never. Didn't really enjoy it too much, the idea, when I got sober. But they kept stressing that to me. They kept stressing the very importance of me being responsible for what I do. My sponsor told me I could do anything I wanted to do as long as I was willing to accept responsibility for it. But if I was to do something and then I didn't like the outcomes or I didn't like the consequences of it, don't come in Alcoholics Anonymous and whine about it, he said. You know, I like what I heard one speaker here just recently say about the difference between an alcoholic and a dog. You know, you let a dog in, they'll quit whining in a little bit. I always wanted to whine about what was going on with me. Somebody else's fault. I would get fired from a job, and I would say to my boss, you know, it's not my fault I stole that $200. You left it laying on the desk. You know, if you hadn't left the money laying out there, I'd have never taken it. My neighbor one time got mad at me because I tried to sleep with his wife. I said, well, she'd quit coming out in the yard in that bathing suit, I wouldn't try to do those things. You know, if that guy hadn't have been crossing the intersection, I'd have never run over him. I mean, it's always somebody else's fault. It was never mine. It was always somebody else's fault for what I was doing. Never. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was here for quite a while before I learned to ask myself, Doug, what are you doing? What's your part? And they told me that's all I was responsible for was my part. And if I would take responsibility for my actions, I could be okay. I ended up 31 years old. I'd been to alcoholic. The first time I was ever around Alcoholics Anonymous was not of my own volition. I believe I got here through the unwarranted grace of a loving God. I believe I got here through the prayers of other people that really loved me, wanting something to be different in my life. And therefore, knowing that I would not walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, even though I didn't really know what Alcoholics Anonymous was, I was quite sure I wouldn't have walked in here. For me, a person was put in my life that needed to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and me being the nice guy that I am and always willing to help others, I said, I'll go with you. And here I sit in this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the one I described to you, and I don't know if that person was supposed to be there or not, but I know today that I was supposed to be there, because it was the first time in my life I ever heard anybody talking about the way I felt. And I continued to come back. I came back for 6 weeks. It was in Christmas, around the middle of December of 84, and they were talking about not drinking, and I thought, well, you know, how am I going to get through the holidays? They said, we're not worried about the holidays. We're just not going to drink right now. And I thought, well, you don't understand. You just don't understand. So I came back for like 6 weeks. Now, the last time I took a first drink after not having one for 6 weeks, it took me 13 months to be able to ask for help again. That's how long that first drink lasted for me, was 13 months. It was in late January, middle January, late January. I hadn't had a drink for about 6 weeks. I was like a little boy whistling in the dark, like it describes in A Vision for You. You know, I thought, well, you know, I'd hear these people talking about how much problems they had when they quit drinking. And God, I felt so sorry for them. You know, like Mary said, these people were talking about how much problems they had in their life. And I thought, my God, you people are sick and you need to be here and all that stuff. And I thought, well, you know, this is no big deal. I haven't had a drink now 4 or 5 weeks. It's not bothering me a bit. See, now everybody knew I wasn't done drinking but me, including my mind. My mind knew I wasn't done drinking. So I was still hanging out in bars, not a good place to be for someone that doesn't want to drink. But that's where I was still hanging out. And a fellow that hadn't seen me for a long time came up to me and said, I haven't seen you for a long time. He said, let me buy you a drink. And now I had Coke. I meant to say Coke, but somehow rum jumped in front of it. I said, I'll have a rum and Coke. And I said, do you hear what you just said? I started talking to myself. Do you hear what you just said? You ordered a rum and Coke and you meant to say Coke. And I still see the vision of the person making the drink and bringing it over to me. And it was like an eternity for them to get that drink over there. And I picked it up and I took that drink and that warmth from here all the way down. And I thought, yeah, you're no alcoholic. Yeah, you haven't had a drink in 5 or 6 weeks. You know, you don't have a problem. And I was right back off to the races again. Three nights later, I took the desire chip that I'd picked up. There was a fellow that I'd seen in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. He was passed out with his head on the bar, and I lifted his head up, and I laid that white chip down, and I laid his head back down on it, and I said, "You need this worse than I do." Well, they always said you try to help people out, right? So I was trying. And I was right back off to the races again. Now, I wasn't knee wobbling, falling down drunk every day, but I never run out of gas. The next 13 months was no different than the previous 17 years. It was no different. I was constantly drinking something on a regular, every day, didn't matter. And drunk when I could be drunk, drunk more than I wasn't drunk. Nothing productive in my life at all. And yet, I still was around Alcoholics Anonymous. I would go to speaker meetings. I wouldn't go to closed meetings because only people with problems went to closed meetings. And remember, I don't have a problem. But I would go to speaker meetings because they said anyone's welcome in a speaker meeting, and they'd tell the funniest stories about themselves, and I'd laugh. I'd be smoking that pot and drinking, and I'd come in them speaker meetings, and they'd tell them stories, and I mean, I'd just laugh till I about fell out of the chair. Now, I know them people knew that I was, you know, drunk and high. And the reason I know that, because I can tell when people are drunk or high today when they come in a meeting. And they didn't say anything to me. The guy that became my sponsor used to just say, "We're going to get you someday." See, "We're going to get you." I thought, "You're not getting anything here, bub." Yeah, so, "You can forget it." So I had all my ill feelings about Alcoholics Anonymous and questioning whether it would work or not, thank goodness for me, was dispelled during that 13th month period. I would sit with them in restaurants, and they'd be working with a new person, and I'd be sitting there, and they'd be telling them all that flowery stuff. Just ask God for help. Pray in the morning when you get up. Pray at night. Read that book, and you'll be okay. I thought, gag me, for God's sakes. Such juvenile, childish stuff. You know, how's that going to help these people? But, you know, it seemed to please them to say it, and the people seemed to be able to accept it and respond to it. And I thought, why would I try to make them really understand what was going on? They look like they really believe this crap. And if they do, then that's fine. But, you know, the flowery stuff, just ask God for help. How's that going to work? How's that going to work? I thought you had to help yourself. That's the way I was raised. You know, I almost died trying to be macho. Darn near killed me trying to be a man because I was failing greatly at what I thought a man was supposed to be. I was not doing good at it. Things hurt me. I wanted to cry. I had these feelings inside of me, but I didn't know that I could express them. I didn't know. I just thought I was not doing something right, and I didn't know what it was. Came to Alcoholics Anonymous, saw and have seen, to this day, continue to see some of the finest examples of men that could ever walk the face of this earth cry. And it started to make it okay. I'm still not real good at it, but I'm a little better than I used to be at expressing feelings. I just couldn't do it. Didn't know how to do it. This program is giving me more than I could have ever imagined giving me. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I told you I didn't have a job. I was unemployable. I wanted to feel better. My sponsor would say, "Get a job." I said, "I don't want a job. I want to feel better." He'd say, "Get a job." I come back the next day. I said, "God, I want to feel better." He'd say, "Get a job." I said, "I don't want a job. I want to feel better." Now, what I didn't know what he was trying to tell me was I had too much time on my hands. A new alcoholic, and even to this day, I haven't had a drink for 14 years. And even to this day, I don't do good for extended periods of time by myself with nothing to do. I just don't do good because I start thinking. And believe me, you know, it don't take me long to come up with something wrong. My mind has never been geared towards the positive things in life. Always the negative. Never. It just doesn't do well on its own. And the reason I believe that is because we say alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and I believe my mind will do anything, say anything to get me to take a drink of alcohol, anything, absolutely at all, use anything, even the program against me. It will use the program against me. I've been sober a few years when my mind would say, "You're sober that long and you're still feeling that away? You know, what kind of program are you working? You should be better than that." And I'd go to my sponsor and he'd tell me like, well, who says you shouldn't be feeling that? I said, well, me. He said, it's not a good place to get information from you. You know, he told me my best thinking got me here. You know, my sponsor imparted all kind of words of wisdom to me along the way. I got upset because they weren't running Alcoholics Anonymous right after being sober for a few years. And he told me one time, he said, we didn't ask you to join. And he's true. I don't remember him ever having a membership drive in my neighborhood. He said it was working just fine when you come. And he said, it'll work just fine if you leave. He said, you don't need to fix anything. And I mean, that kind of things that upset me. But to this very day, I do nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous without asking the old timers if it's okay and their opinions on it. Because believe me, I've always got good ideas and bright ideas. And I've always followed the advice given to me in the direction of the old timers that I've been exposed to. And you know, it's worked every time. It's worked every time. It don't need my good ideas. And that doesn't mean things don't change. But it certainly doesn't mean that I want to leave Alcoholics Anonymous exactly the way I found it, because it worked for me when I come in here. The message was not watered down. The group I come into, it was not watered down. It was the simple message of not being able to live life on life's terms, and if I was willing to take a few simple steps and do some things, my life could be different. That was the message that was given to me. That was the hope that was given to me. And that's still the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. A fellow like me, a person like me, who cannot go any length of time at all without taking a drink, can. And is easily able to do so coming into this fellowship if I'm willing to do a few certain things. It talks about it in the spiritual experience in the appendices in the back of the big book. It says in the spiritual experience appendices, it says this. It says, any alcoholic honestly capable of facing his problems in the light of our experiences can recover. And that's what I did. I brought the problem, me, my problem, me, to the light of the experience of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was able to recover. I had no kind of experience at solutions in my life to problems. Now, I could create problems when I came here. I knew all about creating them. I was good at it. That's all I did was create problems. These people that I was exposed to, they had experience at solving problems. And they said, if you're willing, if you'll follow the path, you too will be able to solve life's problems and live life. And I was. I returned to school. I didn't get a job because I just didn't want to work. I really am. I'm still not real ambitious. Just not. My wife is always helps motivate me. I'm not real enthusiastic. We had to redo my hair before we come up here because I combed it once this morning and it was sticking up all over the place. And so we had to go through and, because I don't care, you know, I combed it once. I think that's good enough, you know. I mean, that's better than when I got here. I can tell you that. That's a whole lot better than it was. So anyway, you know, I got to have help along the way. I went over to eat breakfast and she said, don't get anything on your shirt. And, you know, so I still need a lot of help. But I returned to school. I always wanted a college education, but what eluded me was that in order to get a college education, you have to go to college. Now, that somehow eluded me. I thought I ought to just get one. Somebody just give me a degree because it's me. I deserve one. You owe me. The world, somebody owes me something. So just give me a degree. So I returned to college. I got a college diploma. I don't know how much education I got, but I got a diploma. And this is how God works in my life. I was in Fairmont, West Virginia, getting sober. 5.5 years sober, I went to Charleston, West Virginia to go to work for our state legislature. I had no idea that I was going to go to Charleston, West Virginia, 5.5 years sober. When I first got sober, I didn't run around meetings saying, you know, I better hurry up and get sober and go to school because I've got to go to Charleston in 5 years. I had no idea where I was going to go. Had no idea. I didn't even think I was going to live 5 more years when I came to AA the way I felt. Because my life got worse. My life did not get better immediately upon coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. It got worse. I can remember telling the people that I hung out with, I feel worse now than I've ever felt drunk. And they would say, shut up, you don't know how you felt when you were drunk. How could you possibly know? I can remember the first time I got a cold and I got sick and I had some vomiting and everything. It was terrible. And I went and I said, God, you know, I said, I never got sick like this when I was drinking. And my sponsor said, you could have had walking pneumonia and you wouldn't have known it. Because I was constantly sick when I was drinking. I never felt good physically. So the first time I got a cold, I wanted to whine about it and say, look at me, I'm not drinking, now I'm getting these kind of illnesses and stuff. So I returned to school and graduated, come to work for state legislature. I saw Mary in a meeting, and I fortunately knew some people through service and being involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they helped me to find a place to live. And I asked who she was, and Grace said, oh, said she's going through a bad divorce. I mean, and I could tell the way she said bad that it was not good. I didn't even, I mean, because she rich, I mean, it was bad, bad. I thought, well, you know, I've been sober 5.5 years now. Like I said, I'm sick, not stupid. I knew enough, I didn't want to be in any bad divorce. So we didn't pursue that interest any further. And a number of years, a couple of years later, she, like she told you, I asked her out and we eventually got married. And God's given that to me. God's given that to me. I didn't know that. I didn't know. They used to tell me, though, that when the time was right and I was ready, someone would be put in my life. That's what they told me. Because, you see, when I came here, I had problems with women when I came here. I was breaking up from a very sick woman, and we had a very sick relationship. And I can remember my sponsor saying, you can pray for her to come back, but if she does, don't blame us. He said, it won't be AA's fault if she comes back. Well, today I'm glad she didn't come back. I'm thankful for unanswered prayers and for things that don't happen the way I think they should, because I don't always know best what's best for me to do. The best thing I can do is show up and put one foot in front of the other and do what I'm supposed to do, and things will work out just the way they're supposed to if I have the faith. Not only did I get a college education, I returned and got a master's degree, and I don't say that to brag, just to say that it's never too late. I never thought that I could have anything like that, but I got a master's degree in management, and I've got a very good job with the state of West Virginia. They pay me very well for what I do. And I'm very fortunate man to be able to do what I do today. I feel that I've been placed in a position that I can truly give back to the people of West Virginia after having taken from the state for so long. I always wanted a handout. I was always taking up the time of the courts, the judges, magistrates. Everybody had a problem with my drinking but me. Everybody. My parents had a problem with my drinking. My first wife had a problem with my drinking. Courts had a problem, police had a problem, bartenders had a problem, some women's husbands had a problem with my drinking. Everybody always had a problem with my drinking. I never had a problem with my drinking. On February 22nd, 1986, I had a problem with my drinking. Ever since I owned the problem, I've not had a problem with my drinking, and neither has anyone else since that day. No one has had a problem with my drinking. I told you about my mom and how that happened with her, and I knew that I couldn't undo the past. When I realized that, you know, that she had said something nice to me that day I'd left, and the fact that she was no longer sitting there worrying about me and all the grief I'd caused her, I was almost crushed by a rock of guilt that I could barely slither out from under like a snake. And the only thing that allowed me to slither out from under that rock was what they had told me in Alcoholics Anonymous. If I was truly sorry, if I really had remorse and was truly sorry for the way that I had lived, I never had to do that to the people I loved again if I did not take a drink. I never had to put her through that again if I did not take a drink. And I didn't. I didn't. My mom was handicapped. I was privileged to care for my mom. I always did. Reluctantly, I'd go to the store for her and do her shopping and pay her bills and tend to her house. And God, I used to let her grass grow up so high it looked like we had a, you know, one in botanical gardens or something. And it was always a chore to cut that grass. It'd always take me 4 hours to cut that grass. And after I got sober and started cutting it regular, it took about 30 minutes. It's amazing if you keep it real short and just run the lawnmower over it, how simple it is. But I'd drive down that road looking at her house, that grass would get higher and higher. And I used to think, man, I wish I had time to get that grass cut. Now, the only work I was doing at this time was I was working 4.5 hours a day in a booking joint from 3 o'clock in the afternoon till 7:30 at night. That was my whole job for 5 days a week. And yet I didn't have enough time to cut that grass. That's how busy I was. I haven't, alcoholics, busiest people I've ever seen. You know, guy comes in a meeting, he's late, doesn't have a job. I said, where you been? Busy. I said, doing what? He said, I don't know, but I was busy. You know, so we're the busiest people, and I was always busy. And it is. It takes a lot of effort to stay drunk and to do what I did. It was a lot of effort. I didn't have a lot of free time for anything productive in my life. I was able to take care of my mother, and Mary shared the other night about how her mom died when she was still drinking, but I'm here to tell you, she was able to take care of my mother, but my mother got sick. When my mom got sick, she had cancer, and we had her in the hospital, and I was running back and forth between my job and the hospital and, you know, doing what I needed to do, and she looked at me and she said, I'm so glad you're here with me to go through this with me. And she did not have to worry. She knew in her heart that when I left there, I was coming back. The same guy that in 1974, when I was on leave from the service, she said, will you go get me a pack of cigarettes, a gallon of milk, and a loaf of bread? And 3 days later, I came back with that pack of cigarettes, gallon of milk, and loaf of bread. Same guy, a number of years later, sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. And she was able to know in her heart that I would be there. And that's what this program gave me. I can never repay that. I can never repay for that privilege. And if nothing else ever happens to me in this program, I owe my life and everything I do for being able to do that for my mother, to make up in some small way the pain that I had caused her. I told you I won't talk till lunch, so I guess it's about time. I haven't seen you. Is it time for me to quit? Or you need to do that? I went the other day for work. I went out of town for work the other day, and I thought I was doing a training session. They'd put me on the program for 2 hours and said, you're going to, I teach a class called Personal Accountability for the State Department of Personnel. And I thought that's what I was going to impart to these people, was some training. And they get up there, and I was their guest speaker for 2 hours. They gave me 2 hours. Now, I wasn't prepared to talk 2 hours, but, you know, that wasn't a problem. And I told them people when I got to the podium, I said, I'm really not prepared to talk for 2 hours about this subject, but I can talk for 2 hours. I won't have a bit of problem. You all might have a problem listening to me, but I won't have a bit of problem talking. This is a privilege to be able to do this. When I went to college, the first time I had to stand in a speech class and do a speech at a lectern, that whole thing shook. I was so embarrassed, and the feelings of inadequacy that filled me to be able to stand in front of a group of people and say anything. Now, I wasn't talking about myself. I was doing some prepared speech. But I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my sponsor, I used to hear him say, the more I revealed myself to the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, the more they love me. And I thought, my God, that sounds so good. And it's true. I've stood up places like this or shared in meetings some of the most ludicrous things about myself, true things, and people's come up after me and said, man, I know exactly how you feel. I've done that. I got to be careful out there what I share, because at work for a number of years, this one lady, whenever we'd be in like a little group talking, I'd say, well, you know, one time when I was drinking, and after a couple of years, she said, you know, I've noticed that every time you tell a story, it starts out with one time when I was drinking. And I thought for a minute, and I said, well, hell, I wouldn't have any stories if I hadn't been drinking. How can you have any stories in a dull, boring life without drinking? That's what I thought when I came here. I had no idea what life was. I thank you. I thank the people like this in rooms like this, and I thank the God of my understanding for my life back. Thank you.